This morning we are in Matthew still, Matthew 5. We're just getting started on chapter 13. I'm going to try to do this chapter today, but I really don't see how we can finish it off because there's so much in here, but we're going to give it a shot. So chapter 13, in verse 13, it says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." Now, why salt? What properties does salt have?
Preservative.
And?
Flavor.
Mm-hmm. So these are things that we should be a part of. If you are the salt of the earth, you should add flavor to this world. You should have a preserving effect upon this earth. What Jesus, remember, if he gets into chapter 5, he's given this speech as if he was on a lecture circuit, which he kind of is. He's giving you on the Sermon on the Mount pretty much his whole spiel all at one time. And so we can kind of dissect this between here and the other Gospels. But you can see a lot of his sermons that he's going to use or just kind of pull out. You're going to see those. And one of the most important is that he wants you to realize that this is a new kingdom, that you're a different people, that he's not here to take away the law. He's here to just fulfill the law. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. But he's also trying to get you to understand what's expected if you're going to be a citizen in this kingdom, if you're going to be a part of the world that he is bringing in, or part of the heaven on earth that he is bringing in. This is what he's going to expect of you, and one of them is that you're going to be the salt of the earth, that you're going to be a part, you're going to be a part of the world. Verse 14, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a lamp and put it under a peck measure or a bushel, but on a lampstand and give light to all who are in the house." You notice he didn't say, "Hey, by the way, you know, I know you guys are going to church and everything. It's really good of you. I hope you'll try to be the light of the world." He didn't say that. He said, "You are the light." Now, you may be a dim bulb if you're not shining very much. You may not be putting out a whole lot of light when people look at you, but you are already, if you're a Christian, you are the light of the world. And you're the one who, he says, he's comparing you with him, because he says in several different books of the Bible, of the New Testament, he says, "I am the light of the world. I am the light of the," you know, the gospel is, he is the word, and the light is a guide to men's feet so they know which way to walk. But he's saying, "You are the light. You're the one that's supposed to show them the way."
We're the light through Christ, which is the light.
Right.
And, of course, we're being predetermined for the light also, as it says in Romans 8.
Yep.
Yeah.
Verse 16, "Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven." Now, you know, he didn't say, so that people will see how good you are and know that you're just a great fella. And, you know, you're a fine gal, and everybody's just happy that you're around. No, it's to glorify God. That's why you're to shine your light and to show people the way. To live your life in an example that other people will want to emulate, will want to figure out what you've found out that makes you so much different than everybody else. Verse 17, "Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets, and did not come to abolish but to fulfill." So, he's, you know, when he's starting to say all these things, it does look like Jesus, and we do this, don't we, Miss? Well, there's a good God in the New Testament, and then there's an old angry God in the Old Testament, you know what I'm saying? And he's saying, no, nothing's going to pass away. This is the law that you have read, the law and the prophets, and some of them say, and the Psalms. When they would ever say this, they would say the law and the prophet and the Psalms. So he's saying all the books that he has understood. I also want to remind you of this. He is sitting. See, I'm sitting. Actually, I'm a little higher, so I could be standing. But I'm sitting. But all the people that are listening to him are standing. Can you imagine us going into church? Pastor get up there and sit down in a chair, and we all stand for the entire service. You don't think you'd be saying, "Ooh, I wish you'd hurry up." I mean, we already do it now because we're falling asleep sometimes.
Did he fulfill it at his death on the cross? Or is it going to be fulfilled at his return?
That's a good question.
What do you think? I got my opinion.
I think it's on the cross.
I think it's both.
How so?
His coming fulfills the prophecy that he would come and his ultimate dispensation, our forgiveness, and God's grace is manifest through our lives and what we do.
Doesn't he say it is finished?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
That makes you think he did fulfill it on the cross. That's a hard question.
It's a very hard question. Well, you know, in some respects, I'll just answer part of that. Yes, it was at the cross because he came. Right now, we no longer need animal sacrifices, right? Because he was the one sacrifice, the one Lamb of God who was sacrificed for our sins, take away the sins of the world. So in that respect, he fulfilled that law that required that. I mean, how many of you ladies, when you had your children, you took a lamb down to the church and had it slaughtered? If you didn't have enough money, a dove. That's a requirement of the law. You have a child, you're supposed to go down and make your penance. And those of us that have sinned, every year we come into the temple and we have a Passover. I mean, that's still required. If that hasn't been fulfilled, then we should still be keeping that law, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we believe that it has been fulfilled by Jesus' blood. So yes, in some ways it has been fulfilled. Whether it's been completely fulfilled, I'll leave that up to you guys. Since I got the rest of the chapter to go.
In some ways, he did destroy the law.
He didn't. He fulfilled the law.
No, he
fulfilled it because it had. Otherwise, we have to continue to have animal sacrifices. But he has taken that sacrifice once and for all of us.
Right.
So we no longer have to do that sacrifice. I'd really like to sit down with a rabbi sometime and ask about why they're not, and I'm sure that's an easy question for them to answer, why they're not animal sacrifices today. It's probably because there's not a temple yet. You know, the people in New York are not going to have a temple in Jerusalem to do animal sacrifices if there was a temple. But irregardless, I'm sure there's an understanding with them of why they don't have it.
Colossians 2:14, Paul tells us, blotting out at his death on the cross, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances, nailing it to the cross. So, and it lists all the things on there that he took place of.
Right.
So,
verse 19, whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness and surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. You know what these guys did right then? All these Gentiles and all these peasants that were standing there go, what the heck? They hadn't read the book. They hadn't read the Old Testament. The only way they knew the Old Testament, if they weren't a scribe or a Pharisee, was to have it taught to them by the scribes and the Pharisees. So they didn't sit down with their Bible and have a time of Bible study. It just wasn't a normal thing. They didn't have access to that. So everything they had, and he's going to say here, in the next verse it says, you have heard, because they didn't have access to a Bible. They couldn't read it. So, but Jesus is saying you're going to have to have righteousness that surpasses the scribes and the Pharisees. Well, how do you get that? These guys would take an herb, and if they pulled all the seeds from, you know, some little herb plant, and they had 40 of them, they'd give 4 of them to the temple, because that's how meticulous they were at carrying out the law. They wanted to make sure that they did everything properly and right and down to the letter of the law.
They didn't do the law. That's the problem. They read it. But I just notice here, you shall do and teach the law.
Right.
That's where they fall.
Well, they were keeping. Now, I think what Jesus is going to show us in the next few verses here is that they were keeping the letter of the law, and I'll show you here in the next example that he's going to give us, and I'll bring that out. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whoever shall say, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. What's he talking about? So if I'm angry at somebody, that's the same as murdering somebody?
To a brother. That's important. I read where that's talking about a brother, a fellow brother of Israel, someone that belongs to the
I don't believe that, because here in just a couple of verses he's going to bring up who is your, you know, they're going to ask, who is my brother? Who is my neighbor? You know, and he's going to break down all of those things where he says your neighbor is not just your Jewish neighbor, it is everyone. And he shows that in the Good Samaritan, but he's also going to bring it up right here. So I don't really think that that's what that means.
And it involves those that do the will of the Father or his family. Just throwing in there.
Okay.
I think it's about the propensity. Like, of course, you know, calling somebody a fool doesn't seem as bad as murdering somebody. But if you have the propensity to call someone a fool and feel anger in your heart for that person, you have the propensity to commit murder. We all have that sinfulness in us. And so I think he's just saying, you know, don't just condemn the people who shoot people. Condemn the people who have anger and sin in their heart. And it's all of us. So there's really no...
So what's Jesus talking about, which he always is talking about? He's not talking about what you do. He's talking about your heart.
Exactly.
It's all about your heart. It's what you hold in here. He's going to bring up the next thing. He's going to bring up adultery. And you know, everybody goes, whoa, I haven't committed adultery. Have you ever looked lasciviously at a woman? I'm talking to the guys right now. Or women, have you ever coveted? It's not just talking about sexual sin. Covetousness. Man, I love that dress. Oh, man, that great house. Covetousness. You ever coveted in your heart? Have you ever... I think it was Martin Luther who said, we can't keep from birds flying over our heads. So, in other words, I can't keep from women walking past me. I can keep from having those birds make a nest in my hair. We tend to enjoy our lasciviousness at times, our sins at times. We nurture them. We bring them in and give them a place. And that's what Jesus is talking about. It's your heart. It's not the fact that you've committed adultery. I haven't committed adultery. And some people will say, well, if it's the same thing, if I commit adultery, and it's the same thing as if I've lusted after a woman in my heart, then I might as well just go ahead. How stupid is that? That's not what Jesus is saying. He's not saying go ahead and do it. He's saying don't let this type of thing get into your heart and nurture it there. Get it out. I told Lisa the other day, I was on the greenway and I just almost wanted to cry because I'm going, I can't do all that Jesus wants me to do. And it hurts my heart when he comes back up and says, here, this is you again. And he shows me who I really am, and it just makes me want to cry. Because I'm not perfect. And then Lisa goes, well, we're not supposed to be perfect, which is good. Man. Aren't you good to have a partner? I have one that smacks me around and says, hey, get real again.
He tells you you're not perfect.
And he tells me quite often that I'm not perfect.
So rock, did you get a definition on rock up?
Yeah, I did. I wrote it down, but I can't remember.
I need to move on.
No, I've got it here. Hold on.
I found the Lisa call a blessed one a fool. One that is blessed.
Well,
literally means empty one, but probably
meant
empty headed or foolish.
Yeah, call someone rocket expresses contempt for their intelligence. Calling someone a fool shows contempt for their character. Either one broke the heart of the law against murder, even if it did not commit murder. Commentators have translated the idea behind rocket as nitwit, blockhead, numbskull, bonehead, idiot, brainless idiot. Rocket is almost untranslatable word because it describes a tone of voice more than anything else. Its whole accent is the accent of contempt, but it is the one word. It is the word of one who despises another with an arrogant contempt. And Lisa and I talked about this. We get a lot of talk out of my sermons before I do them. We've been together for 4 days, which has been really nice. But I said, how many times do I go, hey, you know, whatever, when I'm driving?
Yeah.
All the time. And I've described this last week or the week before. I keep getting mad at people. And I don't know whether it's just my age, because I used to love everybody. I really did. But now I'm just getting aggravated with everybody. Kids in Walmart screaming, can't somebody grab that kid and tell him to shut up? You know, the other day I was at Sam's. I want to go over to that tow truck driver and just rip it out of his tow truck. So it's like, you don't need to beat all that.
That has medication.
I think I need some of that. I'm too high strung, and I've been off on these days. I really do think it's a little bit of me getting older and less tolerant of things. And we're so quiet. We don't even listen to we don't watch very much TV. We read. And so our house, without our son there, who's been gone several years, is quiet. I mean, pin drop quiet. Because she reads, I read, and I don't even disturb her that much when she's reading. She doesn't disturb me that much when I'm reading. So to have all this noise when I get out into the world just drives me a little bonkers. And I've got to be... But, you know, God tells us, how could you love me if you don't even love your neighbor, who you have seen? How could you love me who you haven't? So once again, mirror time. Here you are, Larry.
I think some of it is finding that balance. I mean, I was going to say there's a beta blocker that helps with that. But I also think, like when we were in Japan, you know, there wasn't all kinds of stores. I came back for a short while from my friend Tina, and I walked into a Target, and I had a serious anxiety attack because it was so bright, and there were so many options, and it was so freaky. And I was like, the same thing, like if you've gotten quiet, but there were other days where I was in Japan and I was alone for so much, and I would promise myself I'd have a date with God, and I had groceries to do, and I had shopping to do, and I would go places and do things, and I'd smile at people, but you know me, I like to talk, but I wouldn't talk to people, I would just talk to God. And it quieted me though, because it's hard to do, but if you practice it, like while you're driving, you know, you still have to be aware of what's going on around you and stuff like that. But whether it be have on your favorite channel or turn the radio off or whatever,
and
I do think the older we get, the shorter.
And that's my walks when I'm listening to these sermons. Like I told you, if I'm studying, I'm studying whatever the lesson is for that week, and I tend to do 6-8 hours of that. But I love it when I'm not studying, or if I know I've got the week off, because then I listen to Jacob Armstrong over at Providence, or I listen to Jason out in Colorado. And those are like free days. Those are just like whatever they're thinking and whatever sermons they're putting out there. And they're really good. And I know both of them are decent preachers that I tend to enjoy. Let's get back.
Mine is the opposite of yours. I want to go through and not talk to anybody. And I have to make myself think God would want me to tell this person to have a good day or something. I have to kind of make myself do that. It's just like football.
No, I have no
reason. We're gonna get into more of that. We're gonna get into more of your thing here in just a minute. Verse 23. If therefore you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, in order that your opponent may not deliver you to the judge, and the judge and your officer, and you would not be thrown into prison. Truly I say to you, you shall not come out of there until you have paid up the last cent. I'm going to pass over that because we're going to hit some more stuff. You have heard it said that you shall not commit adultery. And see, once again, you have heard it said. So we have heard that. It's one of the Ten Commandments. You shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who has looked on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if you're right, now here comes a big part. Listen, man, y'all got some answers for me on this one? Okay, so we talked about the adultery, so I'm not going to keep going through that. But it says, and if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better that one of your parts of your body perish than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. It's better that parts of your body perish than your whole body go into hell. What's that all about? So we should, if I look on something I shouldn't look on, I should cut out my eyes?
So the right eye means a choicest possession. So maybe they consider the right eye as looking at something and is trying, you know, you're seeing something you really like, maybe not doing away with it or denying it to yourself. It would get you if it's a sin, possibly.
Well, come on, don't just sit there. This is a participatory.
Yeah.
I'll read you what I've got here. It says, Here Jesus uses a figure of speech and did not speak literally. Sadly, some have taken it so and have mutilated themselves in mistaken efforts to pursue in pursuit of holiness. For example, a famous early Christian named Origen castrated himself on the principle of this passage. The trouble with the literal interpretation is that it does not go far enough. Remember, Jesus is speaking to your heart. He's not talking about physical acts of adultery. He's not talking about physical acts of murder. He's talking about your intent and your purpose. If I pluck out both my eyes, that does not take away my lustfulness. See what I'm saying? It takes away the physicality of my lustfulness. If I cut off my hand because it's done something wrong, I still have my left hand. If I cut off both hands, I still have the same heart. It just means I can't physically do it. And so he's trying to put a separation between these. But he says, the trouble with the literal interpretation is that it does not go far enough. Even if you did cut off your hand or gouge out your eye, you can still sin with your other hand or your other eye. When all these are gone, you can especially sin with your mind. Mutilation will not serve the purpose. It may prevent an outward act, but it will not extinguish desire. Okay. So we good on that one now? Alright.
Sure. That is too. Sometimes you have to cut yourself off from people who will lead you astray. So in terms of your communal family, you have to cut off relationships.
Okay.
Participation.
About choices. I mean, I was telling somebody recently about, you know, Frank is deployed so much, and there's all kinds of girls like, hey, let's have a girls' night. And I said, no, we can sit at my house and have a glass of wine. I'm okay with that. But I go out and have a glass of wine, and some guy walks by and touches my arm even accidentally, and I haven't been touched in 7 months. I might like it. So I just didn't put myself in that predicament. I mean, I remember I went to get a chiropractor adjustment one time, and I went home in tears because it just felt so nice. You know, and this is a little Japanese man, Yami-san. You know, he met no ill will. Once you tell him you're okay, I'm okay. But I mean, it's, I had to set myself boundaries.
And you guys know that I'm a hugger, and a lot of you do. Unless you tell me that it's inappropriate. But I noticed that my mom, for some reason, I had not hugged her in a while. And she kept getting worse and worse. I mean, she's going through a lot of problems right now. But she kept getting worse and worse. And now every time I see her, I hug her. And I hug her a lot. And I hug her often. If I'm there for 2 hours, I hug her 10 times. Because she doesn't have anybody there to hug her. And to love on her. And I realize that. And so it's that physical touch that you really do need to have. You know, you'll see me hug half a dozen people down here in the thing. And a couple of them will say, well, I got lipstick on your thing. At least I'll know where that came from. I said, now that I'm in church and she's right there. But I do hug a lot.
It's like if you know, are an alcoholic, don't go to a bar.
Right.
You know, I mean, things that are common sense, but like Marcy said, you have to set boundaries for yourself because we're all sinners and it's too easy to fall into temptation.
Yes.
I mean, that is, you know, that's our nature. And so you just really have to pay attention to the Holy Spirit leading you there and listen to that still small voice, you know, that says it's probably not a good idea for you. It may be okay for somebody else, but for you, This is not good. So
exactly.
That's why Paul said to flee.
He just run.
He didn't say to run. He said to flee.
Okay. This is going to be a tough one to get all the way through this, but we're going to try. And it was said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of dismissal. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except for the cause of unchastity makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Wow. That's a tough one. We could go into this for quite a while if you wanted to, but do you want to?
Was that for the times and in the law?
In the law, they had written in the law that you could literally, and rabbis taught this, if she burned my breakfast, well, then she was being unfaithful to me because she wasn't doing her wifely duties, and so I could divorce her. Just have to get a writ of separation, and I could divorce her. Only the men could do this.
Yeah.
Okay, so that kind of gives you some idea that
the heck out of her and she didn't.
Right, and if he wanted to get rid of her and have another wife, And what Jesus is saying is this whole idea that you guys have set up at this system is you're taking advantage of a situation that was written in law. It's in Leviticus. I've got it someplace. I've lost my thing again. Deuteronomy 24 is what grants that. It's many people interpret the Mosaic permission for divorce as granting virtually any reason as grounds for divorce. Some rabbis taught that even extended to allowing a man to divorce his wife if she burns breakfast. Yet in Jesus' day, this permission of Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, had become an instrument of cruelty against wives. Scribes busied themselves solely about getting the bill of separation into the due legal form. They did nothing to restrain the unjust caprice of husbands. They rather opened a wider door for license. So they weren't trying to keep them together. They were just, this was a good excuse for men to be men if they wanted to be.
And I bet some of the men were paying off priests so they could do this.
Yeah.
And also, I remember Jesus, but, you know, they, a lot of these women, they didn't write them a bill of divorcement. Right. I think that was the big deal. That was, so when they went out, they didn't have nothing. They had to turn to prostitution.
Right. And one of the things that they brought up here is that we may see this as a divorced person. God still sees them as married. He didn't divorce them. So, but here's one quick caveat I've got about that. We as Christians should not look at a divorced person and make that judgment as to, oh, well, you've obviously sinned against your husband and your wife, and now you've remarried, and so therefore you're a horrible, horrible person. Dear Lord, I mean, I don't even want to throw up all the sins I've had in the past week, much less try to say my sins are so much less than anybody else's sins.
And God was a divorcee.
Hmm?
God was a divorcee. In the Old Testament, he divorced Israel, his wife, and married her back.
There you go.
He divorced him.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, you had me on that one for a minute. Now
he took her back, but he divorced her.
Let's carry on. Again, you have heard it said that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say you, make no oath at all, either by heaven or by the throne of God or by the earth, for it is his footstool and his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. He's not talking to you women. I'm sorry. Isn't that funny? I thought that was funny.
Yeah, I've seen them that got their hair so black it made their skin look funny.
Yeah. When my hair started turning white when I was mid-30s, and I asked my barber, I probably told you all this, I asked my barber, I said, should I get it? I don't know all this. Should I maybe color it? And he goes, well, you have to do it every 4 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks to keep it that way. I'm like, I don't like to comb it. There's no way I'm going to take all the time to keep, you know, it's a big deal for me to go get my hair cut and just mess with it. So that wasn't happening. So what it's saying about this oath is that your word should be word. You shouldn't be exaggerating. You shouldn't be, people shouldn't think that you might be telling a fib or a lie. Your yes should be yes and your no should be no. Verse 38, you have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist him who is evil, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn to the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him also have your coat. And whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him too. I want to explain a couple of things real quick. The reason he's saying this is that if somebody lost his eye, people, they were setting a standard that it was an eye for an eye, so that people didn't kill the guy because he took an eye. You see what I'm saying? It was a restriction to keep them from doing too much. That's what the Old Testament law was, because otherwise people would have done more, would have wanted more recompense for it. And this one, verse 40, 41, where it says, whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him too. They were occupied by the Roman soldiers. The Roman soldiers at any time could say, hey, I'm kind of tired. Pick up my backpack, peasant, and walk with me a mile, but only a mile. He couldn't make you walk two, but he could make you walk a mile. But what Jesus is saying is, go ahead and walk two. Show him that, you know, show him what type of person that you are. This other part where up here where it says you are the salt of the earth in 13, have you ever heard anybody called, say, that man's worth his salt? Because Roman soldiers were paid in salt sometimes. So that's why he's worth his salt. He's worth his payment. He's worth what he's due. I meant to tell y'all that earlier. Oh, we're almost there. Give to him who asks you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. You have heard it said that you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemies. Very important. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, in order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. You know, I always thought that they're sending the rain because we hate rain, but that's a good thing. So they get rain. That's a good thing for the righteous and the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax gatherers do the same? And if you greet your brother only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now I send you out. Go, be perfect. You are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. How do we get perfect? How do we stand before God perfect?
Through Jesus.
There you go. The answer always in church is Jesus. I think we're there. Because I just keep going on and on. Thank y'all.
Thank you.
So